it's an important lesson that that's what's really expected of us. And very few people can reach that level, that one, it makes a difference. I mean, had that point, had that principle, you know, been accepted by mankind, you can see throughout history, especially in the Holocaust, the phenomenon of bystanders, how the whole story would have been different had there was a lot of cooperation in many places. We know that the natives of the country either wouldn't help the Jews, or they would collaborationists, and so on and so forth. Some people may have done it to save their own lives, but you see over here that when it comes to a matter like that, that a person has to be prepared to put his life on the line rather than to participate in somebody else's destruction. Anyway, that phase ends. In other words, the plan of Paro to achieve the objective through the midwives basically fails. But then he doesn't give up at this point on the policy. Then he commands, if this is now in chapter 1, the last verse in chapter 1, verse 22. And he tried one more time. And this is very important because it's the connecting link to the story of the birth of Moshe, which we'll be taking up tonight. So this begins with, you need to know this, otherwise you can't follow the story about the birth of Moshe, that Paro commanded L'chol Amo Lemor, his entire nation. It's not clear exactly what that means, whether every particular person, or whether it means all of his the people in his army, police. It's not clear, but it doesn't really make that much difference. It means to say that now it becomes a public phenomenon. Not restricted. Apparently at the outset, of course, he wanted to restrict it with secrecy. So he was hoping to be able to do it before the children were even born. And that was the defense of the midwives, that they couldn't do that. Of course, they hoped that he would just give up the plan, but he tried one more time, and he instructed all of his people, saying that any male that is born should be cast into the river, and every girl that's born should be maintained. Okay, that forms the backdrop. So now tonight we're going to take up the interesting circumstances surrounding the birth of Moshe. Very, very fascinating story. It begins by telling us that there's a certain amount of cryptic. It's not mentioning all the names, as we saw last week. Didn't, according to Rashi anyways, it didn't mention the names of the midwives. Here it just tells us that a man went from the house of Levi and married a daughter of Levi. Now we know who they are because they're the parents of Moshe. So everybody knows who the parents of Moshe. That's the Yocheved is the mother, and Amram. Amram is the father, correct. It's interesting, there's a lot of midrash on this. And of course the question in general is, why is it necessary to tell us that somebody went and married a woman? I mean, that's pretty obvious. The Torah doesn't give those kinds of details. It's pretty obvious. It could have just started with a woman conceived. It doesn't have to tell us this. So there was something about this marriage that's significant. The reason why it's mentioning it is because there's something about the marriage that is significant. Again, Rashi learns that it was a remarriage, that they were married and they separated. That's how Rashi learns. At the insistence of Miriam. Miriam was the sister. So at this point in time, Aaron was the oldest, and Miriam was the sister. They were already born. I think Miriam was the oldest. I'm sorry. Rashi says that he had separated from her because of the decree of Paro. That is because there was no point in having children if the children were going to be killed. So they separated. And then, according to Rashi, Miriam is the one who was responsible, and she said to her father that your decree is harsher than Paro's, because Paro only decreed against the males, and you have decreed even against the females. That is, in other words, if you're not going to have any children, so then there'll be nothing left. So then, according to this, he returned. That's why it says he went and took her. I mean, he retook her. He remarried her. Okay. Whatever, even if you don't learn it that way, and let's assume it was the first time, and they didn't have the separation. That's a midrash, perhaps. But the point is, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's important to tell us this, because there was something very important about the idea that in spite of that Moshe came into the world in spite of the decree of Paro, where, that as many people might have said, that there's no point. When there's a decree of genocide, so why have children only to see them killed? Nevertheless, this was an act of faith, that we have to do whatever we can do. So that's, against this background, she conceived. Then it says she conceived, and she gave birth to a son. Now, the next part of the pasuk is very interesting. It's very strange. You have to notice the subtle nuances in the way the Torah communicates things. What does this mean? And she saw that he was good. What do you mean she saw that he was... What child is not good? The Ramban asked that question. As opposed to what? That he was bad? So that just stands out. And it sort of calls us to, like, explain. Vatitzpineu shloshi yirachim. And she hid him for 3 months. Okay, we understand. She hid him. According to Rashi, again, Rashi says that that he was born prematurely, and they say at the end of the 6 months, so they had 3 months of a grace period, because people knew that she was pregnant, so the ones, you know, that they wouldn't come around looking for the baby until 9 months. Again, it's a midrash, you don't have to learn that way. It doesn't make that much difference to my purposes. The point is, they were able to hide him for 3 months. But then word gets out, you know, that there's a danger. Many people during the Holocaust were able to hide their children. The Anne Franks, they're hiding in an attic. But, you know, after a while, it becomes dangerous, because you got to come out sometimes, and people know, and so on and so forth. So that's the basic idea. They hid him as long as they could. But what we have to remember, I'll come back to it later, is what is the Torah telling us when it's saying that they saw that he was good? Well, what does that mean? What's a good baby as opposed to a bad? And the implication is that since they saw that he was good, that's why they did what they did, as opposed to had they not seen that he was good. So there's something very, very significant over there. And then the story goes on, and they could no longer hide him. So she took for him. It's not saying who took for him. Vatikach lo, she took for him. Who? The mother, I suppose. Okay. A basket. So they made him a little cradle, a little basket of papyrus. And then they plastered it with clay and with pitch, you know, whatever they could do. And they put the child inside, and they put him in the reeds by the riverbank. Interesting. And his sister watched from the distance to find out what happened. So she stood behind. It's interesting. This becomes very significant later on, that she didn't leave and she stayed there. And later on, you know, this is Miriam. And the Torah records how she spoke against her brother, Lashon Hara. You know that. And that you'll discover in Bamidbar. I mean, it wasn't malicious or anything like that. But the Torah uses that as the example that even on any level whatsoever, so she was punished with saras. It's translated leprosy, but it's not real leprosy. And they waited for her, and the people waited for her for 7 days. So the rabbis say that's a reward, because she waited for Moshe, so the people waited for her. So she stood around. She plays a very significant role. It seems trivial, but it's not. What I want to know is, what was the plan? What kind of plan is that to save a baby? Does it make any sense? It doesn't seem to make any sense. Usually you want to smuggle the child or find someone who's a friendly or whatever. It just doesn't seem to work. Because how do you expect, how long can a baby survive? What's going to happen?
Especially with crocodiles.
With crocodiles? Or just without food? And it can sink? And you'd imagine if an Egyptian would find them, they would know. It's just like what happens. They're going to know it's a Jewish baby. What other baby? Who's going to put a baby in the Nile? They, you know, it's pretty obvious that it comes from the Jews. So what kind of a plan? It seems like a very strange kind of a plan. Okay, maybe it's desperation. Okay, if that's what you want to say. Sometimes you have no choice, and you just do something out of pure desperation. But is that the case? Were they acting that way? Okay. What happens next? The daughter of Paro went down to wash in the Nile. That's where she used to bathe. And her maidens were walking along the banks of the walking by the river. And she saw the basket in the middle of the among the reeds. And she sent her maid to fetch it. And this pasuk is very interesting. Take a look at this next pasuk, Vav 6. And what's interesting about this pasuk? Again, look for the word or the phrase that's seemingly superfluous. Well, I say superfluous because the Torah is so lean. It, you know, provides so little information. You know what's... I'm just questioning why the Torah has to point out and make an issue out of the fact that he was crying. This seems like a trivial point, and all babies cry. And in the Torah, which normally doesn't give anything extra, I mean, to the contrary, you want to know more. If you were writing a newspaper article about a baby that was found somewhere, and when they found him, he was crying, he might have mentioned he was crying. Who cares? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? Babies cry all the time. But here the Torah is telling us that the baby was crying. That's why it's something which requires explanation. And so she saw that she opened it up. She saw the lad, the youth. It wasn't a lad, it was a child. And behold, he was crying. And she took pity on him. And she said, "Miyaldei ho'ivrimze." That's also that he's one of the Jewish kids. She figured that out. It's very, very interesting. After the order, after she saw him crying and she takes pity, then she says, "This is a Jewish child." Is there something to the order as well? Very, very interesting. Now, Na'ar Bocheh, here's an interesting Rashi. You have to learn how to interpret a Midrash. The problem is that people take Midrashim literally sometimes, and it's not meant to be taken literally, it's meant to convey a point. So the rabbis say that Gabriel is an angel, came and like hit Moshe so he would cry. Okay, maybe he wasn't hungry, but just an angel of God came and like hit him on the face and he started to cry. Okay, now what's the reason for that? And what is the plan that they had? And what is the idea that they saw that he was good? All of these different things. It's very, very interesting. The Rambam talks about Moshe Rabbeinu. He describes the situation, what befell the Jews in Egypt. And as we said, that... What happened to them, that they were enslaved and they were mistreated, was a result of the fact that they sinned. We pointed that out, that they began to, when they grew, when the great leaders died, they began to assimilate. And the Rambam talks about this too. And when they assimilate, we also learn this, it'll come up later on, that they adopted the customs and they became involved in idolatry. That the Jews became involved in the worship of idols, like the Egyptians, and later... In order to be worthy of redemption, they had to be separated, and that's why God gave them the Passover sacrifice, to separate themselves from idolatry. So the Rambam describes it that things reached such a point that, practically speaking, almost, it was on the verge of losing the entire foundation that Avraham had established, because it all goes back to Avraham, and that he had discovered the idea of the true God, and the complete nullification of idol worship, and that we should only direct ourselves to the Creator of heaven and earth. And then God intervened. And this is the expression that he uses, and God created, or God made, Moshe Rabbeinu. And he sent Moshe Rabbeinu. That's a very, very, very interesting... What do you mean God made? God made everybody. So the point of this is that... we don't believe in predestined individuals, that this particular person is predestined to be the Mashiach. A lot of people have this notion. There's no such thing as a preordained individual. Rather, not anybody is eligible, because in order to be Mashiach, you have to be in a very exalted level. But there could be, there could be people, a group of people in history that have the capability. And whoever, due to the situation, due to his capabilities and so on and so forth, if he achieves what Mashiach has to achieve, so he becomes the Mashiach. But it's not preordained. For example, the rabbis believe that the Bar Kokhba, you know the story, that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach, because he had tremendous capabilities and so forth. But unfortunately, he sinned. So it wasn't preordained. Had he not sinned, would have been the Mashiach. You see what I'm saying? It's not that there's a certain hand-picked individual. The only individual who was preordained in all of our history, it wasn't preordained that Avraham should discover, or that Noach should. No, Noach was Noach, and he used his free will, and he did the right thing. It wasn't preordained. He wasn't sent from heaven in that respect, in the way most people think about these things. Neither was Abraham. Abraham was an individual. He had tremendous talents, tremendous abilities, and he was motivated to use them, free will. Free will, and that's a very important idea. A person should never, ever think that that's it. I was destined to be a failure, or I was destined to be a success. No, you weren't destined to be this or to be that, because you have free will. And if you utilize your capabilities correctly, each person has his own makeup, his own capabilities, and not everybody could be an Einstein, but you're not expected to be. What you have to use, don't strive to be that which you're not. Strive to be what you are. Of course, that's not so easy. It's easier said than done. Because whatever it is, you know, we look out there and we want to be like this one, we want to be like that one. But you should really try to be like you are and try to make the most, to make the most out of what God has given you. However, according to the Rambam, my interpretation, there's one exception to that rule, and that is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was a very unique individual, one of a kind. He's the only person of whom we say one of a kind. If you go through the 13 principles, right, of Rambam, the 13 principles of faith, so one of them is belief in prophecy. That's a foundation, that there is a phenomenon of that it's true, that it's accurate, that God does communicate with man in a manner that man knows. Revelation. But then he says that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is special and unique. That's a separate principle in and of itself. That Moshe Rabbeinu reached a level of prophecy that could never be duplicated. And that's how the Torah closes. Lo kamod, that they'll never arise. They'll never arise a prophet like Moshe.
That's a
Yigdal. Yeah, they'll never arise. Well, that, of course, but that's where it comes from. It comes from the Torah. Yigdal came later. That God knew face to face. That is to say, that the prophecy of Moshe was differentiated, completely qualitatively differentiated from any other prophet. They all prophesied in a vision, and it was a metaphor, and it had to be interpreted. And God, and then also they had to be in a special state. They weren't in their natural waking state. Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem communicated with him word for word. There was no visions. There was no interpretation. It was word for word. So the Torah that we have is not something that is prophecy like the subsequent books. It's word for word from, quote unquote, the mouth of God, so to speak. Obviously, God does not have a mouth. But I'm just using the expression. And also the wonders that were performed. That's another principle. That God does not perform miracles except through a prophet. He's the instrument, so to speak. Of course, Moshe didn't split the sea. Hashem split the sea. Moshe doesn't have the power. But God only brings that about through a qualified individual. So there's different levels of miracles. And the miracles that were brought about by Moshe, the public miracles, shattering the laws of nature, so to speak, were never duplicated by any other prophet. So Moshe Rabbeinu is predetermined for the task. Now, that doesn't mean to say, so you'll ask me a question, if that's the case, we're going to read later on that on the return trip to Egypt, apparently Moshe sinned, that he delayed with the circumcision of his son, and God sought to kill him, and Miriam... So how could that happen if he was before he did the mission? How could that happen? That doesn't mean to say that Moshe didn't have free will. Moshe was a great person, and we're going to read about his heroism, what he did. But what we're talking about is that in terms of setting him up and giving him those, that combination of characteristics that he had, which if he would utilize them would enable him to reach that level, that was foreordained. So what we're studying over here is not just an ordinary birth of a child. This is something which is a manifestation of divine providence. Everything that's happening in this story is not just, you know, things happen. Sometimes, I mean, most of the things that we do, we're doing, it's not divine providence. We're acting in accordance with the laws of nature. You know, a woman is pregnant, she goes to the doctor. We're not saying it was a miracle. You don't mean it's a miracle. It means a childbirth is not a miracle. There is, of course, we do believe in divine providence. And we always pray for divine assistance. Sometimes it's very difficult for us to know. Is this a result of, you know, you made a good decision and things were, it was fortuitous? Or was it a miracle? These things are not easy to decipher. But there are certain things that come down to us from that we know are miraculous. So what's happening over here is something which is under the control of divine providence. Now let's study how the divine providence manifested itself. The plan, they executed a very, very daring kind of a plan, which I at first glance doesn't seem to be, doesn't seem to make sense. To take a baby and put him in a cradle and put him in a river, it's very dangerous. I mean, how long can you survive? So why did they do it? What motivated them to do something so extraordinary? So the Ramban, now we're getting back to the fact that, remember we said that they saw that he was good, and then they, like that was sort of the impetus because they saw that he was good. So the Ramban, I'm quoting the Ramban, that's Nachmanides. He says it's known that all women love their children, whether they're, you know, good or not good, whatever, pretty or not pretty, or they're all babies are beautiful to their parents. And of course they would all hide them as long as they could. So why is it, so there's no need, he says, there's no need to mention that he was good in this context. So he says, but the what does it mean, tov? The word tov is a very important word. It's used in the description of Bereshis, creation, and God saw that it was good. So they saw something unique and special about this child. And they saw something, he doesn't say what it is because he doesn't know what it is, but they saw something very unusual. Rashi says that when he was born, the whole room lit up with light. I don't know if that's meant literally. I think it's trying to convey that notion that there were certain things that were beyond the natural order. They sensed that there was an element of divine providence. And therefore it gave them the encouragement to believe, to try things, to be more creative. Sometimes a person needs an impetus. It's an amazing idea that your state of mind will have a big effect. When you feel like it's kind of hopeless and there's nothing can be done and you give up, so then you're closing yourself off from certain possibilities. There are always possibilities out there. And the rabbis go so far as to say that even if the sharp sword is on the neck of a person, he shouldn't give up hope for divine mercy. But we're not even going that far, and that is that if a person approaches a situation with a certain fatalistic attitude, all right, I'm just going to go through the motions, whatever, so pretty much that'll determine it. So you'll just go through the motions, and you probably won't, you know, you probably won't achieve success. But if you really believe that this, that in Hashem, and that this is really, really important, and you resign yourself to doing whatever you could do, then you may discover certain things. And they may sound crazy. On the surface, this plan doesn't sound like much. And you'll have that, and most people will say it's ridiculous. But no, a person with a certain insight will have the courage to see that there's something in this that other people don't see. So what was the plan over here? I think the plan over here, because the pasuk, the very next thing, as soon as they place the baby down there, guess who shows up? The daughter of Pharaoh. And the daughter of Pharaoh was a very interesting kind of person. Was she like her father? No, isn't that interesting? So you're not determined. It's not, you'd think the father is Pharaoh. He's a cruel individual. He's an oppressor. He's prepared to wipe out all the Jewish boys. But it's not like father, like daughter. No, they must have known something about this. It is very, very interesting. So what kind of a person was the daughter of Pharaoh?
Compassionate.
Well, was she completely... sometimes you don't know. Sometimes a person has elements of compassion, but she's still Paro's daughter. You see, she's still referred to as the daughter of Paro. And if you take a look at the pasuk now, the way it works out, and this is divine providence, the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was in the cradle, and just when she opened it, he cried. That's what the rabbis meant. The angel came and smote him because God wanted him to cry. Had he not cried, and that's correct, as you said before, that's right, because he cried, it evoked a special. She would have had compassion, even if he didn't cry. Are we saying that you only have compassion on a poor kid? No, but you see, she was involved in a struggle. She was involved in a struggle. You see how the fate of an individual, and this is the whole nation, can hinge on timing of a certain emotion. Whether or not she's going to, because she had resistance, because she's the daughter of Paro. And she knows that the law of the land is that if you find a Jewish child, you're supposed to cast them into the river. So she's not supposed to. So she's attracted. She sees, because she has an emotion of compassion. So she instructs her handmaiden to get the basket. And she's caught in a trap. But before she could, that's why it's very, very important. Which comes first? That she realizes that he's a Jew? If that comes first, then he's cast into the sea. If the emotion of compassion comes first, then he'll be saved. That's why the pasuk has it that way. That God worked it out that her emotion of compassion should be aroused. It's a very, very important thing. And that's exactly what they had hoped for. That's why they placed him over there. They knew that he couldn't survive. But there was no other choice. They knew that Paro's daughter would go there. It wasn't by accident. They must have studied the situation. The Torah doesn't tell this to you. But they saw that he was good, and that's they began to start thinking now. Let's think. But they had 3 months. You see, they were thinking. And when a person thinks into a situation, you never know what you're going to come up with. People do not exhaust every possibility. I mean, a lot of times people come to me for counseling, advice, this and that, and they feel that it's a hopeless situation, there's nowhere, and then I just start, let's think it out, and then I come up with, because I'm not bound by the same things, I'm neutral, I'm objective, and I come up with all kinds. This may sound crazy, but this may sound completely crazy, but let it be stated, maybe it's crazy, but what does it hurt? And sometimes it is crazy, but there's a little kernel of something that you can pull from it, but people are afraid to think. And of course, after you come up with an idea, you got to analyze it, whether it makes sense or doesn't make sense. But now you have much more stuff out there, which you weren't even aware is out there. You thought it's hopeless. You had one or two things, and that's the end of the story. That's it. But if a person has the capability of thinking and thinking out of the box, and not afraid to, you know, be creative, he can come up with possibilities. That's what I think was going on. And this would sound like the craziest idea in the world. But with divine help, you see, you can't just sit back though either. You can't, even though they were relying on Hashem, but they didn't just sit back and do nothing. You can only rely on Hashem when you do what you have to do. That's an important teaching, that our view of divine providence, and we believe that Hashem watches over us, it is not an idea of just sitting back and just have faith in God. Just giving it over to you, God. You do. That's not our idea. That's other religion. You have to do everything in your power, because that's part of your perfection. And hopefully to act in accordance with reality, that your plans should be intelligent to the best of your ability. And then you pray to Hashem. And hopefully Hashem will, yeah, they did whatever they could do, and divine providence comes in, she comes there, she takes it, and it's interesting, and then divine providence causes them to cry. Without that cry, who knows what would have happened. But that cry evoked, it tipped the scales. Now she was just too attached. And then she said, yeah, he's Jewish. But that was after already she was committed to the child. After she was committed to the child, then she realizes that it's a Jew and she has to defy her father. What happens next? See, now you see where Miriam comes in. That as soon as she saw this, that's why it was very important, her being there was very, very important. And she said, and his sister then said to the daughter of Paro, shall I go and call for you a nursing a woman. From the Ivrios, from the Jewish ones. Vesenik, and she will nurse the child. This is very, very important. At first glance, it's not so clear. Well, so it turns out that the mother is called in. That's Yocheved, of course. And Miriam, it says that the daughter of Paro said, go. And the young girl went, and she called the boy's mother. Of course, it was her mother, too. And the daughter of Paro told her to go. I'm sorry. She brought the mother. And the daughter, this is very interesting. The daughter of Paro tells her, take this child and nurse him for me, and I will pay your wages. And the woman took the child and nursed him. This is very interesting. What do you even know about the wages? Did the daughter of Paro know who was doing the nursing?
It's not clear.
What would you say?
She might have thought
it was? Yeah, but see, what bothers me is I'm getting the sense that this was kept secret. Because first of all, if it's the mother, then what do you have to pay her for? I mean, you're right? I mean, that just any mother would be happy. You wouldn't take money for nursing their own child. I'm sorry? My theory is that they did not say that she was the mother. She did not know.
No, of course.
Assuming that the daughter of Pharaoh wanted Moshe to adopt this child and raise this child, then you don't want to give it back to the mother. The mother may change her mind and keep the baby. You'd have a problem with that, I'd imagine. So that's why she didn't say, I'll get the mother. Miriam was very careful. She didn't say, I'll get the mother. I'll just find them among the Hebrews. It's a Hebrew child. So I guess in those days, perhaps it's true even today. I don't know, from the physical standpoint, if it's better. We can assume it's always better, you know, like a mother and a child. This is a Jewish child, I'll get one of the Jewish women. Maybe there's some connection. Maybe it's better that way. Maybe they have the same genes, even though they didn't know about genes. But I don't think she told her it was the mother. Because, first of all, the fact that she's treating her like she's an ordinary nursing woman who gets paid for it. And there's no indication that she knows it's the mother. To the contrary, if it was the mother, she might have been reluctant. Because the mother's going to want to keep the baby and not want to give, you know.
Whereas, why'd you put it in the week?
Then it says that, so apparently you have to assume that she nursed him and then she gave him back. Because in the next pasuk, we're learning, this is in pasuk 10, that the boy grew up. This is the first growing up. And she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh. So she kept her agreement. Vayhi lo levein, and she became his son. Meaning, she became a son to the daughter of Pharaoh. Now, and she called his name Moshe. Interesting. And she said, because I fetched him from the water. See, in verse 11 it says, it was in those days. Then again, vayigdal Moshe. He grew up. And he went out unto his brothers. So Ramban points out, this is the real growing up. The first growing up just means that he was old enough to be weaned. Okay. So how many years? 3 years. Okay, so he was a kid. He was 3 years old. Now we're going to learn about Moshe, that Moshe grows up and he becomes a man. So say he's about, we don't know exactly, say he's 13, 14, teenager, around that. The Ramban does calculations. Anyway, he's like a teenager, okay? Because he's now old enough to think for himself and to go out in the world and do things. So then it says that Vayigdal Moshe, I'm in verse 11, that he grew up, and he went out amongst his brethren, and he saw them in their afflictions. So it means he went out to study the situation. He was troubled by the afflictions of his brethren. And then he saw an Egyptian who was hitting, who was beating up, striking a Ish-Ivri, a Jewish man, Me'echa, from his brothers. Now you can see the redundancy. How many times does it have to tell us that they're his brothers? The Torah is using the word. What becomes difficult is the strange behavior of Moshe. It mentions the brethren twice over here. But Moshe sees that. Moshe is concerned about that. And he looks around. And he smites the... he saw that there was nobody watching. And he smites the Mitzri, the Egyptian. And he buries him in the sand. Okay, and then he goes out. And the next day... I don't want to get into that right now. Because they get into all kinds of problems with the Jews. That's what happens. You try to help somebody, you try to be a protector. Okay, that's what we'll get back to that next week. But that's exactly the question that's bothering me, that Moshe Rabbeinu somehow or other knows that he's a Jew. Not only that he knows, now did he get this information when he was a baby, he was being nursed? Well, how much could they have told him? Let me ask you another question. Was Moshe Rabbeinu cognizant, was he aware of who his mother and brother and sister were? Later on we read that God modifies the plan, and when Moshe didn't want to be the spokesman because he had a speech problem and he wasn't charismatic and that whole thing. So then God gets angry, and finally God says, okay, your brother Aaron the Levi will be your spokesman. And so apparently Moshe knows who his brother Aaron is. It's like a given. Because otherwise, how would that help Moshe? And then he says, you'll go back, and he'll meet you, and he'll see you, and he'll rejoice. So Moshe Rabbeinu apparently knows who his family is. I have a theory about this. We can speculate. And as long as you have come up with an answer that doesn't contradict anything and it's reasonable and makes sense, it's fine. But if it's something which is supported by the psukim and it elucidates something in the verses, then it gives it more of a basis. So I want to suggest that here too you see an expression of divine providence. That of course it was the will of God. See, when Moshe went out, Moshe was concerned about the plight of the Jews. So that would mean that he identified as a Jew. And this, of course, was a test. Now, how far? I mean, it's one thing to be a Jew, but what about when you see another Jew in trouble? And he made a tremendous sacrifice. He risked his own life and his whole status, because he knew what was going on. So he must have had a very strong attachment to the Jews. And given the story, as we're reading it, that he was just, all right, so he was nursed and so on and so forth, whatever he absorbed, it's not enough, it would seem. Because then he grew up, he was 2 years old, 2.5 years old, she brought him back. How much do you remember? How many people can remember what happened when you were 3 years old? What would cause him to go back? What would cause Moshe Rabbeinu to go back? Now, I would imagine that the Yocheved couldn't go to the palace. She had no access. She wasn't even the mother. She was just the nurse. And she paid the wages. That's, I believe, why she wanted to pay her wages. That's it. Job is finished. It's over. So what's the connection? And he's now, he doesn't know to go there. He doesn't know that this is his mother. Now, I would suggest the following. It's all in Pasuk 10. It's all in Pasuk 10. Divine providence. And it is telling you that they named him Moshe. And the reason for the name is because I pulled him out of the water. That's very, very important. You see the power of a name. Names are very, very important. You see in the Torah. Today, we don't look at it the same way. We don't look at names the same way. Today, we choose names for various reasons. Generally, if there's someone that died, you would name them after someone. That's not the way it was done in the time of the Torah. Or you like the sound of it. But a name should have a greater significance. To name somebody after a great person, and that greatness has some meaning to you, is very important. Why is it important? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said the fact that he was named Moshe, and Moshe was the lawgiver, I mean, he was one of the great poskim decisors. I mean, that had an effect upon him. Because, a person has an interest in his name. And what's the reason for the name? Or why am I named after this person? So, it has an effect. Now, this is a strange kind of name. Moshe was a genius, obviously, and he was very curious. But this is a strange kind of a name, Moshe. Right? I don't think there were too many people named Moshe over there. No. So that Moshe would want to know, he had to know that Moshe had to know that he was. She didn't tell him that he was her son. Okay, so he had to know that he was adopted. Okay, so every child that's adopted has a tremendous curiosity. What's the story? So she told him the story about the fact that that's how I found you. That you have to assume that the very name means I was pulled from the water. Well, what's the story behind my name? That you assume that she explained to him, that she was going by to bathe. That's the story. I mean, that of course every... Okay. So Moshe would want to know, well, how did I get there? Who was my real parent? Okay? How would he be able to make the connection? The only way to make the connection was through the nursing. There was a nursing. That's what the. In other words, he would then ask, "Well, who nursed me?" Oh, they had the. You know, she paid. They must have had the records, whatever it was. So then she told him who it was that nursed you, and Moshe Rabbeinu was able to then go and find out, and when he who nursed me. Once he found out who nursed me, so then he was reunited. At that point in time, they told him everything. So what I'm saying is that at some point, as Moshe was growing up, he was brilliant and he was precocious, and he was very curious because of the name. And so he spoke to his mother about it. And his mother told him the whole story. Now he wanted to know more about his background, because now he knew that he wasn't an Egyptian, he knew that he was a Jew. So I'm saying the only link that tied him back was the phenomenon of that nursing woman. Oh, there was a girl there, and there was a nursing woman, and I paid her, and we were, and so then, once he set out to discover, he was able to discover it through the nursing. That's why the nursing was very, very important. You see, and that's why the Miriam standing by and waiting was very, very important. Had she just left at that point, she would have seen that power to... the daughter of Paros, and she just left at that point, and she wouldn't have made that link, then Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't have had any real connection to find out who he was and where he came from. That was very important. Yeah. I'm saying that if you don't have this background, then there's no reason why should he care about the plight of the Jews. He's not a Jew. So what? I mean, he was born a Jew, but now he's an Egyptian for all intents and purposes. He's in the palace of the king. He was raised. But it's more, he was raised that way. But there had to be in his consciousness a very strong awareness of why he was pulled from the water. He needed to know that. And when he found out why he was pulled from the water, he found out about the Jewish people. And he found out about whatever they told him about the Jews and about the affliction of the Jews. And then it became important to him when the time came and he got older to go out and see what he could do about it.